So when I talked to our next speaker, he said that there are things that, as skeptics, we are very happy to challenge, but then there are certain things that we're not happy to challenge. And I went, such as what? And he said, evolutionary psychology. Challenge evolution. I love evolutionary psychology. It explains to me why we're afraid of heights or public speaking, but we're not afraid of toasters or of air travel. I mean, you're aware, aren't you, that after 9/11, thousands and thousands of people stopped flying because they were afraid of aeroplanes and drove. And as a result, the number of deaths in America really went up. If they had flown, they would have been safer. Then, of course, they are Americans, aren't they? Shouldn't have said that. We love Americans. John Key said so on The Tonight Show. Didn't ask me. Oh, I love Americans. So the question is, what are we open to be challenged about and what are we not open to be challenged about? And it's good to be challenged, isn't it? I think it's great that we're challenged and we should challenge ourselves. And Bernard Bickett is the man who is going to do that. Bernard, welcome.
Thank you. Hey, look, thank you for still being here at the end of the day. And I thank you in advance for listening after many, many speeches. And that might be a thanks that's not earned, but we'll just see how we go. There's something slightly brave about a skeptics conference organiser asking a writer of fiction to come in and talk to you, because it's not entirely clear where the whole link's going to be. And I said, sure, because basically when people say, do you want to come and talk, I always say yes as a first instinct, and then think, what will I do? And I'm still going through that process, but I think we'll be fine. And that's why this whole evolutionary psych thing was just mentioned, and it's not really in the program, and we'll see where we get, because, you know, as I say, my trade really is two things. It's teaching, so feel free to talk during this, chew during this, text during this, throw things at me during this, yell questions out, you know, it's fine. And in fact, I'm going to feel a little weird if it doesn't start happening. The other thing I do is I write, particularly novels. That's sort of my background. I did, however, have a year in 2005, which I loved, at the Ellen Wilson Centre, based at Massey University, working with people like, I'm going to mention later, like David Penny and Mike Hendy, who are fantastic New Zealand scientists, and I was already falling in love with science, but that was the end point in lots of ways, and it was just the changing point of that. I was going to say the consumption of it, but that didn't quite work. The thing I think I really want to talk about is this. I don't know much about Skeptic Society. And beyond what you see in the newspaper, sort of what makes it out into the world. And so I sort of thought to myself, gosh, would I want to belong to this group of people? And I really didn't know. I am by nature fairly skeptical. I enjoy skepticism. I enjoy arguing. I enjoy challenging. But I'm also fairly relaxed about what other people think and feel. I sort of don't care often. You know what I mean? If someone really wants to believe that they can twitch with a stick and find some water, most of the time I just think it's sort of funny and fun, and I'm even prepared to accompany them along. You know, I don't get wound up about it. Most of the time I don't care. But of course, and I suspect you know that too. I'm not assuming you do care about those sorts of things. But I started thinking, what do I care about? When do a skepticism or the need for skepticism start winding me up personally? And I know it does happen. We're pretty close to the Beehive. I was once in there for a job interview in a cabinet minister's office, and I won't name, I don't think, but I might if I change my mind later. Anyway, I went in there, and it was a communication sort of style job, and it was her and there were her three staffers, and they were talking about various things, and it was humming along reasonably well. And then she asked me, just to check out how I would get on with the rest of the staff, what star sign I was. Now, I'm often asked what star sign I am because, you know, those people are out there and I try to jolly them along and lie or make them guess and all this normal stuff. And I don't mind at all, most of the time. But there was something about it that sort of, I went, oh, really? A minister of the crown? You're sort of like making decisions that matter with our money. Damn. And it was something deeply sort of disappointing. I must admit, at that stage, I wanted to, you know, that was a good time to want to run out and join the Skeptic Society. Because, yeah, it sort of hurt a little in some way. I'm absolutely happy. I grew up in a fairly religious home. And my parents are still, to an extent, religious. And I'm happily atheistic, but happy to sit round with them while they pray and all those sorts of things. It really doesn't worry me in the least. But again, sometimes when you hear them again, it's maybe badly reported. But sometimes when you hear about some of those George W. Bush prayer sessions, you know, around about the time of key policy decisions, that scares the hell out of me. So that's one. And so I think there are two groups, actually, when I suddenly feel my scepticism rising, and that might just be where the planets are at the time, of course. But the two groups, I think, are people in real power, position power, positions of power. And even as a teacher, I'd have to say, I'm a little bit worried, you know, when kids come out and say, guess what we learned last spell in history? And you go, no, you didn't. What? Hitler was what? A Sagittarius. that concerns me. I think there's another time I get concerned. And maybe this is because I have a false expectation of academics. But I sort of worry too when I hear stuff coming out of, in a way I guess, and maybe this is a patronising thing to say, the mouths of people I reckon should know better. So people who are highly educated, highly respected, loads of money going in, books being published, research coming out. I want them to be sceptical. Maybe that's just me wanting them to be like me, you know? Most of the time, I don't really care if people aren't sceptical. But those two groups, I think, really wind me up. The very powerful, people in positions of power, and I think academics, for some reason. Now, I might be puzzled. I'm going to try to end with about 15 minutes of questions, and it might actually be me asking you stuff. I don't know where you sit on evolutionary psychology. I just know that my understanding of it puts it pretty damn close to astrology. And I'm going to define it as carefully as I can during this speech, because that's not entirely true. There's some stuff that I would think of as evolutionary psychology which seems superb. But there's a whole heap of stuff that seems to me is published, is fated, is academically supported, is accepted and praised by biologists as well as, you know, literary critics. And I find that weird. And it might be I'm missing something. I'm going to explain to you during the speech why I find it really weird. And I'll pull up with enough time for someone in the audience. And I'd love to go away with, oh, that's what I was missing about evolutionary psychology. I'm not here to say I want to, you know, rid the world of the scourge. It could well be I need to jump on the bandwagon. But I don't get why I would. You probably... I spent the year at the Alan Wilson Centre, amongst other things, studying the philosophy of science, in the sense that I wrote a book on it. And you'll know a lot of this stuff, and you're always in an audience, you're walking, and think, damn, I don't, you know, I want to tell you how to suck eggs. But I will, just let me spend a little bit of time on what I came to think about as good science, so I can explain to you my problem with what feels like really weirdly bad science with evolutionary psychology. What do I think of as good science? Well, the more I read of the philosophy of science, the more I became convinced it's very, very difficult to come up with a philosophical definition. I think in the end, good science is what good scientists do. I think it will probably be judged on practice rather than on the abstract, because I think the abstract is absolutely fatally tied up with notions of truth with a big capital T, and I think it gets messy and it gets silly. So what's the practical side? The first group who really, really impressed me in terms of science were the pre-Socratic Greek scientists, if you like, for want of a better phrase, although clearly they wouldn't have called themselves that any time before Thomas Huxley in the 1800s, the 19th century. But I loved that, at least in terms of our recorded history, here suddenly was a group of people who were obsessed with asking the hows and whys. How does it work? What's it all made of? You know, Thales is sometimes credited as the first Western philosopher for saying, what's everything made of? And irrespective of his answer, which was water, the fact that he asks a question is stunning. Out of nowhere, almost, why would you assume everything's made of something other than what we see? Why can't goats be made of goat stuff and trees made of tree stuff? The very I don't reckon because I've seen things in the world, I've seen things evaporate, I've seen things rot, I've seen things change, you know, state. It's an amazing question to say maybe it's all made of something more basic. Not only maybe, but here's why I reckon it's made of something more basic. And it opens up the most important part of science, which is the return question. Well, if everything's made of water, for example, how come some things float and some things sink? Oh, damn, well, maybe because... And the dialogue begins. Those people impress me. You know, Democritus saying, I'm not really sure what it is, but I reckon we could get everything down to these really small, fundamental details. Well, I'll think of a word for them. He thought of a word, atoms, which, you know, gave us both a word and a concept. They amaze me. My favourite story from old ancient Greece, and I like going back there because otherwise you always get the Europeans invented science around about the time of Francis Bacon and Galileo. Clearly something really amazing happened around that time, but I like that there are prior stories. You probably will know, so I won't spend long on it, but kids love the story of Eratosthenes and his ability to get a working crack at how far around the world it was, just by making two measurements in Egypt. And for those of you who don't know the story, it is such fun. As it's reported, the Greeks had an idea that the world was probably round, because there were some things that only make sense to them if they could see the roundness, if they could think of it in round terms. One of the ones that's often cited is the fact that when they saw distant across the sea the ships returning, they'd notice the top of the sail before the bulk of the ship. And one possibility for that is curvature. Clearly there are other possibilities, but, you know, it was, hey, here's something I don't quite understand about the word, here's an hypothesis, which clearly in itself isn't science, and this is where I'm going to fall down with evolutionary psychology. It's the beginning, the possibility of science. Eratosthenes is told of a well in what's now known as Aswan, I think. And they said, hey, look, this is a really amazing place. Because when the sun's at its zenith on the longest day of the year, the sun shines straight down that well. And people come along and they look down the well and they see the bottom. And they're sort of like a tourist, you know, attraction. Cool. And in the time before the iPhone, you know, you had to do something. And so you waited for the longest day of the year. And you knew your mates would be there, and that saved on texting. And Eratosthenes, rather than saying, hey, that's cool, I'd like to look at it, made a far, far bigger leap. And he said, if that is right, then I think I can show the world around. Because I know of a well where I live in Alexandria. And I also know roughly how far it is, and in fact we can measure it. And I reckon if the world's round, then probably wells, you know, point pretty much to its middle. Yeah? We certainly drop, you know, a string and a weight down when we dig them, so we don't get a lot of dirt in the bucket every time we bring it back up. So if the world was flat, they'd be parallel. The world is round, two worlds sufficiently a few hundred miles apart won't be parallel at all. They'll be coming at different angles, like pins in an orange. So if the sun, which is sufficiently distant, so we don't have to worry about that aspect, is shining straight down that one and the world's round, at the same time, at the highest point on the longest day, it won't be shining straight down my one. That's something I predict is true if the world is round. And there's no reason to predict it if the world's not round. And isn't that crucial for science, yeah? Isn't that absolutely crucial? I've come up with a novel prediction, one that my theory or hypothesis generates, and which I can test. And he went one step further. He said, I think the maths isn't beyond me then to measure the angle of difference. And if I know, if you like, the size of the arc and the angle of difference, hell, I could probably work out how far right around the world is. There's some debate, I'm told, and I'm no expert on this, about how good his calculation was, because it all came down to what the units they were using were, and there's much debate about how that translates into ours. But the romantics like to say he got really close. I don't really, in some way, care about that aspect, because I'm sufficiently blown away and attracted to what he did, in terms of, here's a theory we've got, here's some data I could collect, here is a novel prediction. Not a prediction about something we all already know about. Not, if my theory of gender difference is right, then I predict men will be generally taller than women. It's like, no, you dick, we know that now. That absolutely cannot be evidence of what you think happened in the Flintstone era. So that's pretty cool. And of course, some amazing things did happen in Europe, and this has become politically interesting. How much you are allowed to talk about the amazing things that happened in Europe. In the 16 and 1700s. And I'd like to talk about lots of other places, because then it would all be more smooth and happy. But look, some remarkable stuff happened. It's hard not to be impressed by a roll call of, you know, Galileo and Hooke and Descartes and Newton and, you know, and on it goes. It's massively hard not to be impressed by this incredible excitement that occurred. And these almost stupendous, to me, mind-boggling repeats of Eratosthenes. The old, let's work out how much the Earth weighs. It's like, what? How? Are you insane? No, I think I can talk, look at what the mass of the Earth does to the mass of another object. If I could just enclose it and get it out of the wind and build the... What? They had a crack. Let's work out how fast light travels. It's like, choice. You'll do what? Oh, we'll go to distant hills and we'll get these mirrors cycling away with slits in it and they'll go around really, really fast and we'll know their thing. And then we'll measure under what circumstances the light comes back and hits this mirror or doesn't, depending on its spinning. And I was like, wow, crazy. A prediction if it's travelling in this way at the speed I think that. My favourite, I'm going to tell you two science stories that just blow me away before I get to evolutionary psychology. It's quite good. As a fiction writer, I understand you get up, you make a promise, everybody hangs on the promise, and then you're going to do other stuff. That's how novels work, right? And then either you deliver on the promise, and they go, that was really, really good, or you know, it's lost, and you make five more theories, right? So maybe I'm going to come back next year, or maybe I'll get to evolutionary psychology. We'll see. Two more examples. Brian talked about, you know, light, particle, and wave. The details of quantum mechanics escape me, to be honest. Luckily, they escape everybody else, and that's why we're still arguing about it. The mathematics don't escape people, so it's a fascinating thing. But I love the story of Fresnel, the Frenchman who was the designer of, dealing with the light and lenses and lighthouse lights and so forth. Because the French Academy had a competition, a prize, for the best explanation of the behaviour of light. Now, at that time, post-Newton, Newton was considered pretty much the god of science because he'd done some remarkable stuff. And he said light travelled as a particle. So that was sort of taken as a given. And the judges on the academy thought, well, that's a first point. But we said, there's lots of things that puzzle us. Sure, the particle explains certain things like refraction very, very well, but there's lots about light that's still puzzling. We're going to give a prize for the best model of how light works. They only got two entries. And one of them was from a nutter. So they couldn't give the prize to that person. It was just I've just read it was unbelievably bad, which is an incredibly poor piece of writing from that person, because gosh, I wanted to know how bad. The other one came from Fresnel. And it was considered, it was mathematically worked out, was a good model, except it modelled light as a wave. And the judges said, we're stuffed. We can't give it to the village idiot, and we can't give it to the person who says Newton's wrong, and we have no other, you know. In this day and age, they would invent a third entry and we'd be sweet. But, you know, they didn't. And they worried about it. Poisson, the famous mathematician, was one of the panel. And he said, well, maybe we can just dismiss, say we can't give a prize for this reason, but we'd better dismiss Fresnel. We'd better be able to dismiss it. Give me his equations, I'll have a look. And he had looked at his equations, he said, oh, sweet, this is not a hard thing to do. Look, this guy, this fool, if you take his wave equations to the logical extreme, he's actually predicting that if you get a very, very small particle obstruction in front of the light and shine light at it, because of the way the waves are going to wrap around, you're going to find the brightest point directly behind it. Now, we all know light's not like that. It casts shadows. That's where the darkest point is. So he said, sweet, so we're fine. But he was even better than that Poisson. This is why we have to admire the man. He said, we'd better check it, right? Now, I love that he said that. That's something I love about science. Gosh, here's this hypothesis. It's clearly wrong because it makes that prediction. It's a unique prediction. No one's thought of it before, and it's not going to work. So we got a very, very good practitioner to do it incredibly carefully, and indeed it was brighter behind. And so, not only does Fresnel get the prize, but science gets this wonderful boost of, gosh, now you have to explain both aspects. And that did give us quantum mechanics, which has given us, you know, so much modern technology, plus some wonderful things to argue about. Now we get to evolution. We're only one step away from evolutionary psychology. See? Now we get to evolution. Karl Popper quite famously had some worries about evolution. And I'm sorry to mention Popper, because it seems to me that whenever people want to talk about philosophy of science, they only mention Karl Popper, as if he's the only person who ever wrote on the philosophy of science. But he spent some time in Christchurch, so you know. His concern with evolutionary theory, publicly stated, was, I'm not sure I'm seeing the generation of unique hypotheses. I reckon you're still at the hypothesis making, but not, sorry, the unique predictions. I'm not seeing the predictions. I'm seeing you doing a lot of gathering of data and observation and then fitting it into a model in a creative and smart and often elegant and consistent way as science requires. But he said, just publicly, I'm worried about the lack of predictions. You should be too. I don't know how fair that was. After all, Darwin himself was deeply worried that the Earth wasn't long enough, old enough, hadn't been around long enough for evolution to have occurred as he liked. He made a very strong prediction, the Earth should be very old. And Kelvin said, well, it ain't. Kelvin was the man, you know. So it looked like they were in trouble. And our own Ernest Rutherford helped out tremendously with dating techniques and also with the concept of radiation and finding another way by which the Earth was producing heat, because Kelvin was using the notion of a cooling Earth to get his date. So there was a really, really strong prediction that looked wrong and then later turned out not to be. That feels pretty good to me. Certainly Darwin realised there had to be some way that information could be passed from one generation to the next, the notion of what we now call, you know, the gene, or unit of inheritance.